This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is this outbreak of insane war violence the new normal? If we can't keep our greenhouse gases down to nature's level, humanity is doomed to a continuing hot and violent future. This harsh news comes from a team of scientists in Austria. Dr. Thomas Gasser is a senior research scholar with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. Thomas coordinates the Earth System Modeling Research Team. He helped develop a new program that is more realistic to the way nature really works. Gasser is lead author of one new paper and co-author of another, laying out our long future risks. From Luxembourg, Austria, Thomas Gasser, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, it's good to connect with you. So we last talked in 2018 about feedback from the thawing Arctic permafrost. And recently, you and your colleagues are back with new work on the implications of long-term feedbacks. What got you working on these problems?
Well, I think essentially two aspects that really were consequences of the previous work on permafrost. The first one is that since we had focused on one of these long-term impacts of climate change, permafrost thaw, we wondered whether some of the conclusions we got would be the same with another long-term impact. So we wanted to derive more robust conclusions from our work. The second aspect actually is also related to permafrost, but goes much broader than this, is the notion of uncertainty. And so the two papers we are going to discuss consider this notion of uncertainty and explore what we can do with this uncertainty and what kind of decisions can be taken despite the uncertainty.
Okay, well, let's begin with your new paper published February 26th, Negative Emissions to Mitigate Earth System Risks. It sounds like governments are expecting one knob to control the whole temperature, but Earth systems are not one thing. Thomas, what was missing from the picture we have been using for decision-making about the future?
So I want to insist first on the fact that we know a lot about the Earth system and we understand the major processes and the reasons for the global warming we are seeing today. And we are integrating more and more of what we scientists call the second-order processes, so more and more feedbacks in the system, consideration of more subsystems of this broader planetary system, and we are getting a better and better picture. But what remains true is that we have a lot of uncertainty to deal with when we consider a quantitative description of the Earth system and its different components. And so what was really missing, or what is still missing when we discuss what is the best decision to take given the current state of knowledge, is how to deal with this uncertainty. It is how to decide, given that for some aspects we are really not sure what the exact number is. For instance, how much carbon will be released by permafrost in the future. We know carbon will be released by permafrost, but we're not quite sure how much, and the uncertainty is relatively huge. So, of course, scientists are working to reduce this uncertainty, but the question we were asking in that paper specifically was, given the current state of knowledge, given this uncertainty, what could we still decide? What is the best decision right now, given that?
Yes, we can't wait for perfect answers because the Earth system is changing underneath of us. So many of our expert guests on Radio EcoShock tell us long-term processes in nature are unlikely to stop whether we control emissions or not. Thomas, talk to us about the importance of time-lagged impacts.
Time-lagged impacts is maybe a bit of a jargon word. It really means those long-term, slow impacts that occur after a long term, after having, for instance, emitted carbon dioxide. So the climate system is a involves the whole planet and is a very, very slow system. So we will see only in the long future the impacts of what we are doing today. And this is, of course, important for various reasons. First of all, because it also means that nowadays we are seeing the impacts of what we did even several centuries ago. But as we are disturbing the system more and more and faster, we expect to see even more of those time-like impacts in a faster fashion. But it's also important for questions of intergenerational equity, a question that we have to consider the future generations and what our current actions are doing or will do to these future generations.
In fact, your group finds we will have to remove more carbon from the atmosphere for hundreds of years?
Essentially, yes. And this is really because of those slow, lagging impacts, is that right now, even if we stopped emitting right now, we would see the atmosphere would keep warming up, and even after the temperature roughly stabilizes, we would still see those time-like impacts. Permafrost would continue thawing, and especially sea level would continue rising. And so what we explored and is that if we actually want to limit those long-term slow impacts, we shouldn't just stop emitting. We really have to remove carbon, CO2 especially, from the atmosphere.
Glaciers will melt, sea levels will rise for centuries, permafrost keeps thawing, oceans release heat. If there's nothing we can do to stop that now, why go through the social and economic pain to rearrange everything into the low-carbon ways?
Yeah, I think this is really the key question. I think it's really important to understand that climate change and impacts from climate change are not a binary issue. It's not it's happening or not. It's not we are winning or not. It's not we passed the point and we should give up everything. It's really every fraction of a degree matters. And so we should always consider what could be done to improve the situation. Yes, sea level will rise, permafrost will thaw, oceans will release the heat they have accumulated if we stop emitting CO2, but capturing this CO2 from the atmosphere would lower the impact and would compensate at least some of that and perhaps all of it, if we want to be optimistic. So again, what is important is that every bit counts, and even capturing, if we manage to do this technologically, I should say, capturing carbon from the atmosphere would reduce those impacts.
Thomas Gosser, let's move on to another paper you co-authored and published January 2026. The title is Stabilizing Time-Lagged Climate Impacts Requires Net Negative Emissions for Centuries. So that's sort of what we've been talking about. Your new results show we need to get to net zero CO2 emissions a decade earlier than previous estimates. That's new to me, and that could mean just 15 years to stop loading up the atmosphere. You investigated four scenarios. What is the best we can hope for, starting from where we are today?
That's a very difficult question you're asking here. I cannot say what is the best we can hope for in terms of what humanity will be doing or what we can hope humanity will be doing. It's very, very difficult to... It's essentially predicting the future, right? So that's not what we do, obviously. When we do science, we investigate, we make scenarios. And in those scenarios, we are... in that specific paper, we are looking at some number of risks, and especially risks related to not being able to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, or at least not as much as we think we could do right now. and we investigate. And basically, this is why we conclude that we have to reach net zero earlier than in other studies, is that given the fact that there is a risk that we will not be able to develop the technology to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, then we have to curb down emissions as soon as possible. But what I cannot tell you is what will happen, obviously. And so, of course, stopping emissions entirely within the next 15 years seems extremely daunting, and you have to be quite optimistic to assume this will happen. But again, we investigated more like what if questions rather than just what will happen.
Well, absolutely. So what if we go above 3 degrees C, for example, 3.5, even by 2100? What does your worst-case scenario suggest will happen? I know this is not future-telling, but what would the scenario suggest?
I think we have the answer to that question in just the previous IPCC reports. We know the rather pessimistic scenarios that you're describing, something like 3 to 4 degrees by the end of the century, lead to significant impact on the ecosystems, on the society, especially on the most vulnerable within each society. And yeah, we know that this is what would happen. But again, I want to insist on the fact that every fraction of a degree counts. So if we can find ways, even if the initial pathway we are taking is not the most optimistic one, is not the best one, we should always make an effort and consider that fighting or like reducing emissions and removing CO2 from the atmosphere can only lead to benefit in terms of impacts all across all possible sectors and again ecosystems and for humanity as well.
Well, trying to get there, this new paper considers legal ways of controlling emissions, the law, and it starts with a July 2025 decision by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, and the court found climate treaties already signed by nations impose binding obligations on those states to protect the climate system. What does their ruling mean?
First of all, a disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer, but our understanding of the ruling, and I think this is a shared understanding across the scientific community, is that if a country has signed a climate treaty, they have committed to protecting the climate system itself, because essentially more climate change, more global warming, means more damage to the people. So it is really just this link that is fully recognized by the International Court of Justice between, in this case, emission of greenhouse gases and the damages and how harmful it is on the people.
But as we know, among the major powers, the United States, Russia, China, and India, they have not accepted compulsory jurisdiction of that International Court of Justice. So this climate ruling is not accepted or being enforced by the world's largest polluters?
That is absolutely true. And this not much we can do about that, at least on the short term. We use, in that paper, we do quote the decision from the International Court of Justice, but really as a motivation to explain that if we want to follow that logic, the ruling itself, we have to limit those time lag, the impacts. We have to limit specific climate impacts to avoid damage to the people, to society. Of course, the major powers you cited do not recognize the International Court of Justice. One could still imagine, perhaps, that national Supreme Courts or equivalent could, at some point in the future, come up with a similar conclusion, you know, a similar decision. But at this stage, there is indeed nothing to actually, no entity, no global governance or global entity that could enforce such a decision.
Well, suppose we get international action, and I think it will happen with enough climate pressure. How do time-lagged impacts work into the responsibilities for wealthy and heavy polluting countries that they bear to help the future?
Sorry, time-lagged impacts work in two ways in this sense. Wealthy, heavily polluting countries have been emitting greenhouse gases for decades, and centuries even. And so it means that they have been impacting the climate already, and what they have done in the past and will do in the future will keep impacting in the future as well. And so one aspect is what we call loss and damage. It's essentially, to simplify, financial compensation for the damage of the most vulnerable countries need help that can be financial or otherwise to adapt to climate change, or also help to mitigate and avoid following the same pathway that richer countries have taken. So that's one aspect. It's something we discussed actually in a third paper some years ago with the same group of authors, is the notion of carbon removal obligations. That's something that does not actually exist right now, but that could be a international system to force emitting countries and heavy polluters to produce carbon capture in the future. The idea is to say that if a country has been emitting a lot of CO2, it has a debt, essentially, and we could imagine an institution that could control that debt and, assuming some way of enforcing it, could tell countries that how much they have to capture to actually balance that debt, because countries have been putting CO2 in the atmosphere for their own economic development, and the idea is that now they have an obligation to remove it. So rich, heavily polluting countries then within such a system would have in the future to remove carbon from the atmosphere because they have been heavy polluters.
A new industry for the UK and America and Germany and many other countries. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is research scientist Thomas Glaser from Austria. We're talking about the long future of carbon capture that we're forcing on future generations. So, Thomas, in addition to the permafrost thaw and the rising seas, which I think you studied in depth, we have oceans releasing massive heat since the Industrial Revolution. Arctic ice will continue to shrink, and that reduces Earth's albedo, which is often left out, and so more solar energy comes in. You've got so many things. I mean, land and ocean sinks may weaken. Does this paper manage to consider these other factors, or is that still work to be done?
So of the different factors you cited, that actually the paper does, or like our work does, consider all of them. Ocean heat release, Arctic ice melt, and change of Earth albedo, for instance. These two are fairly well understood processes. So most climate projections now include these. We also consider the weakening of the future land and ocean carbon sinks. Again, of course, there is uncertainty in those factors, but this is exactly what we looked at, is what decisions can we take given the uncertainty in those factors. So I'm actually quite proud to say that we have, of course, not all existing factors or feedbacks in the system, because we keep finding some of them, but again, the main ones, the first order processes, we included them in our study.
With unstoppable problems like sea level rise, we get strange effects. For example, is it true that future societies working to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere will see less and less benefits as they keep going decades and centuries later?
Well, the Earth system is a complex system. And as we've already discussed, it has a lot of inertia, a lot of those slow processes that keep happening a long time after any perturbation first happened, like emitting CO2, but also removing CO2. So the answer to your question really depends on what we call the removal profile itself, that is, how much effort would be done to remove at what time. But if we really want to avoid those long-term impacts, we really have to remove for a long period of time. And so the benefits, we would see some benefits immediately, but benefits would accumulate as well over time, as long as there is removal happening. But it is true that then if we stop removing, then things will again slowly reach a new, what we call a steady state. And so the marginal benefits would decrease. But again, this is only after stopping the removal activity. And what we concluded in those two studies we've been discussing is that we need to remove for a long period of time, probably a whole century, during which we have to keep removing CO2 from the atmosphere.
How does the problem of time-lagged impacts compare to the logic used in overshoot, where global temperature allegedly reaches a dangerous point but then comes back down as humans remove massive amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere?
So there are two ways those two notions really interact. The time-lagged impact impacted by the overshoot, in the sense that if we overshoot our temperature targets, say we are aiming at what? We were aiming at 1.5 degrees C. And if we overshoot that temperature and then go down, to go down, I have to insist we need to capture CO2 already there. There's no way to lower the temperature without capturing CO2. But so if we go above our target, those impacts will be more than at the target level. Say we reach 2 degrees instead of 1.5, obviously we will have more climate impact. But what will happen then is that it will make overshooting even more difficult, in the sense it will make going back down more difficult. Because it will, for permafrost flow, it's a very clear process, because this releases more greenhouse gas in the system. It means that if we get above the temperature target, we will get even more CO2 and methane in the atmosphere than anticipated, and therefore to bring back the temperature to the target level, we will need to capture even more CO2, for instance. So there is a clear interaction between those two notions.
The paper warns, quote, "Delays to earlier mitigation not only raise the median impact level, they also increase the spread of projected outcomes." Please explain what that means.
Again, this relates to the notion of uncertainty, but we often talk about temperature change in the future, about climate change, with just one number. We say, 2 degrees, 3 degrees. But this is often the median impact level. So this means that it's a 50% chance of being higher than this, but also a 50% chance of being lower than this. What we looked at also is what we call the spread of the outcome, meaning the uncertainty on this, and especially the higher, the most extreme outcome. And what we concluded is that if we delay mitigation, yes, we do increase the median impact level, as we discussed previously, for instance. Say, if we don't act fast enough by the end of the century, we will reach 3 degrees of global warming. But the more extreme case, that is less likely, but still a chance of it happening, would be in proportion more than the change in this medium impact level. So say, between early mitigation and late mitigation, we reach the median level reached is 3 degrees instead of 2 degrees, but maybe an extreme possible outcome would be 5 degrees instead of 2.5. So the difference increases for those extreme outcomes. So this is what we meant by this statement, and I hope I made it clear.
Actually, you did make it clear, and I appreciate that. Now, another difficult thing to talk about, that technique that you use in this paper, and I think listeners would just fade out when anybody talks about Bayesian analysis. In fact, big business and bankers use this technique to quantify risk management, whether they call it that or not. And this type of inference requires three steps. We begin with a starting state of historical data and beliefs, and then we update that as new data arrives. And finally, we make decisions despite the uncertainty, which is something we've been talking about. Is that not happening, all those stages with the global climate models and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports?
Well, it is happening, but in a way not fully. So it happens with the purely physical science, so the pure knowledge we have of the climate system. Of course, we update that knowledge with new information, and we get a better understanding of the climate system and its potential response in the future. But it's not fully happening when we design scenarios, when we try to quantify what is the best decision to make given this uncertainty. And we managed to bring in some notion of uncertainty and some of the Bayesian principles, but it's actually very difficult to do for purely technical reasons. It requires essentially a lot of computation power to fully solve, mathematically solve, I mean, the system to get the proper answer that would fully respect the Bayesian principle. And so this is what we did in that study, but we had to do something is to simplify many aspects of the system down to essentially the core, some core equations that we know are physically and economically meaningful to be able to solve it mathematically.
You and your colleagues created a new model to include uncertainties about climate and humans will react. Tell us about Pathfinder.
Yeah, maybe the name is a bit on the nose, but Pathfinder is a simple model of the Earth system that has been built with really the idea of exploring pathways, future pathways, and exploring ideally all of them, which sounds impossible because there's an infinite amount of pathways, but we are still designing ways to do so from a purely mathematical perspective. And so this relates to my previous answer. This is really a model that is mathematically simple, but accurate enough that we can describe the key components of the Earth system, including some aspects of the socioeconomic system. And so this is a model that we've been using to explore a large number of scenarios and to try to reduce or to bracket what possible future could be, but also what decisions should be taken, given a number of assumptions and availability of technologies, as I mentioned, and given objectives of limiting climate impact, for instance.
It seems even with the best new techniques, results are still a best guess, given huge uncertainties about both climate and what humans might do in particular. And I can picture governments saying, well, come back when you really know what's going to happen. Should we wait for more science and better models before we make serious decisions on the climate?
No, we should not wait. And that's exactly the point we're making in that first paper we discussed. It's really that, of course, nowadays there are uncertainties, and there will always be uncertainties. But if you just wait for everything to be certain, we don't take any decision. So the best is actually is to consider these uncertainties within the decision, basically. And there's a lot there's a field of research that is called decision theory, and there are a lot of principles and let's call them algorithms to take decisions given the uncertainty, and this is what we have explored there. Really, we know enough to take decisions now, but also we can include all these uncertainties into the decision to come up with the best decision given what we know nowadays.
Saving the climate, it sounds like, requires institutions that can endure through centuries, no matter what political or personal changes may happen. And this is a challenge humanity has never really met. What are the limits we are leaving for the many generations to come?
Yeah, you are absolutely right, Alex. This is a challenge that has never been met by humanity. We are facing climate change. It is a new challenge for humanity. But I think it also means it requires new solutions, essentially. And we are quite convinced that this requires new institutions. And of course, when you look at the state of the world nowadays, talking about global institutions seems absolutely crazy. But nevertheless, we don't see any other way to tackle the problem. Of course, we also need the bottom-up approach. But when our conclusion is that we have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere for centuries, we don't see any other way for it to happen than actually having some sort of global governance that would make sure that it is happening, because no one, as an individual, no one can do that. And of course, this has implications for future generations, but I think it's exactly why it should be done, essentially, because the future generations will benefit from this global governance and global institutions.
What are you working on now?
we are following up on this idea of uncertainty, really. This is a big topic of research for us now. And one of the things that we want to look at is actually this notion of overshoot we have discussed. Now that we have all but passed the 1.5 degree threshold, the whole scientific community is talking about overshoot. The big question is how do we go back to that level? But a lot of the solutions that are proposed at this stage are called nature-based solutions. They rely a lot on reforesting, on doing bioenergy, growing bioenergy crops, and burning them for energy and capturing the CO2 from the burning and storing it in geological storage. And these sort of technologies that are not fully developed. What we would like to look at is how much climate change impacts the availability of those technologies, because we are talking a lot about overshooting, that is going back to 1.5 or even below, but I think it is an open question whether we can actually do that, and I think it has a lot of implications also for adaptation. Because I am personally, and as a scientist, I am a bit afraid that that the whole community will look at the question of overshoot. I'm afraid we will give the impression, we will convey the idea that we can do it. And I think this is an open question right now, whether we can.
From the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria, we've been speaking with Dr. Thomas Gasser. Find links to the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. It is all open access, free. Thomas, thank you for leading us into this long future.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about the real world.